Hi, I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
And this is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thank you for listening in. We're recording this show in Kuala Lumpur, the capital of Malaysia, which is where we both live and work. And this, Hannah, is the second edition of our very own podcast.
It really is. We'll be launching officially in January 2020, but we wanted to put out two preview shows before the end of 2019. So in the first show, Gary and I have interviewed each other about our travel histories, our varied careers in the tourism industry, and just why we decided to launch this podcast in the first place.
Yeah, and in this show, we're going to take a look back at the 2019 travel year. It's been a fascinating 12 months here in Southeast Asia, which has probably strengthened and diversified its profile around the world. And we think it's become the world's most dynamic tourism region. So we've selected five key themes that we think define the travel and tourism year here in Southeast Asia during 2019. But before we begin, both Hannah and I are just going to go back to our travels. We've both been traveling for business and work, for business and pleasure this year. And recently, Hannah, you were in Manila. So what were you doing there and what did you find?
Yeah, I was. I was in Manila for a travel trade show. It was a B2B show. So part of what I do is I represent travel companies. And it was interesting. I hadn't been to the Philippines for a couple of years. I was in both Malate, which is kind of the older part, and Makati, which is the new business part. It's very sparkly, brand new. But what I really found interesting was that there's still a very deep interest in the Philippines to travel to Europe. I mean, I was representing European tour operators, so we were talking more about Europe, but there's still this hunger to go out, even though they have to get visas, and it's maybe not always cheap or a fast process. Mm-hmm. They're doing it nevertheless. It doesn't matter to them.
You hadn't been there for a couple of years. Are you going back anytime soon?
Maybe at some point next year, but I think that would be later on the year, so maybe same timing. Something like that, but we'll see. And I think you've just come back from Myanmar, right?
Yeah, I was in Yangon last week for 4 days. Hadn't been there for 8 years. This was my first time back since 2011.
How was it?
The center of Yangon hasn't changed too much. It's still, the architecture is still beautiful and decaying. Mm. But there's a lot of construction around the fringes, as you tend to see in a lot of Southeast Asian cities.
Yep.
There's a lot of big condominiums and mixed-use sites going up. Mm. So there's a degree of change there, but it's a lot slower. But one of the interesting things that I noticed this time, which I didn't notice in 2011, is the number of Chinese tourists in downtown Yangon.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
I think there were some flights launched this year from Shanghai. I think the first time they launched direct flights.
Okay.
And yeah, it's definitely on radar this year.
Well, that leads quite nicely, actually, to what the topic of this podcast is, which is what are the five biggest trends that happened in the travel world in 2019 in Southeast Asia. And the first one is China versus India, that intensifying battle for inbound arrivals, as Gary calls it. So Gary, I mean, you were saying you saw a lot of Chinese tourists in Myanmar. Is this a trend? Are we seeing more Chinese outbound tourists everywhere?
Yep, we are. This was a very interesting year in a number of ways. The year got off to quite a slow start in Southeast Asia. Mm. We've seen Chinese arrivals grow in most nations across the region over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Indian arrivals too.
Yeah.
Indian arrivals tend to be a little bit smaller and they're concentrated in more pockets of the region.
Yeah.
But the year got off to quite a slow start. And there was a great concern among the tourism industry that the U.S.-China trade war, in particular, was going to slow growth into the region.
Yeah.
And also that this year there was going to be a stronger demand for Chinese domestic travel, and that might take some of the region's travel away. Chinese New Year was relatively quiet. Some countries, particularly Thailand and Vietnam, were suffering.
Yeah.
But it seems to have picked up in the second half of the year, and now we're really seeing again this big sort of battle between tourism boards to attract tourists from both India and China, looking at the secondary and tertiary cities, not just the big primary cities, trying to attract more flights in. And that goes hand in hand as well. A lot of tourism boards in the region are looking at Australia, they're looking at Korea, Japan, trying to diversify their inbound mix a little bit more.
Yes.
But we are still seeing that China does dominate the debate very much.
I mean, it does. And I think even if you're going around Southeast Asia, kind of anecdotally, you always get people complaining, I guess. So I went to Angkor Wat and it was swarming with Chinese tourists. Or like you say, I went to Myanmar and there were Chinese tourists everywhere. But often there is a... Sometimes I think that could be a negative perception.
I think it can. And I think that tends to focus a little bit more on the package groups, know, the group tours, which can be quite large. They can be overpowering, like you say, in places like Angkor Wat. Although I think Angkor Wat towards this year has tapered off a little bit because I think it's been done. You know, there are new places on the horizon. Yeah. But I think the interesting aspect is the FIT market.
Yeah.
And that's particularly what you're seeing in Yangon. You know, you're seeing a lot of young couples, you're seeing groups of friends, you know, they're eating and dining in nice restaurants in the city, enjoying the architecture, enjoying the art.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of next wave that we're seeing. Earlier this year, I was in Bangkok, and I was amazed at the number of Indian tourists in the city. It's really taken
that
off in the last couple of years.
Question.
And so you're seeing these different pockets, these different areas of growth from both markets, and that will definitely move into 2020 for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So do you think the Indian market is more groups, or it's more FIT, or it's a blend of them both?
It's a blend of both. We're in an interesting position here in KL because KL is quite a transit city for Indian tourists into Southeast Asia.
Yep.
A few weeks ago, I was in Bali, and the flight was pretty much, apart from myself, was almost exclusively Indian tourists that were using KL as a way to get into Bali.
Yeah.
And that was a mixture of both. There were small groups, but there were also families.
Yeah.
One of the things you tend to see with Indian families is they do travel as extended families.
Yes.
So you get bigger groups of actual just family travelers.
Yeah.
And Bali Airport, you know, and I've been going to Bali for many years. I'm lucky enough to have an apartment there.
Yeah.
But 4 or 5 years, when you arrived at that airport, the airport queue was pretty much exclusively Australians. Then about 3 years ago, that switched and it became Chinese.
Okay.
This year, and the two trips I've made recently, Indian tourists. I think that's just a real, shows how this region is changing quite fast. Whether those trends will pertain and whether they'll dilute or be more concentrated, it's hard to tell. But
yeah.
You're certainly seeing that Indian travelers are really starting to make their mark. And we're seeing this in the tourism boards that we work with and that we see is that they're making more effort to reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, there's a lot more air links as well. So, for example, Malindo in Malaysia has lots and lots of connections to the Indian market. And yeah, they use KL as that transit hub to get to Bali, to get to Jakarta, to get to Bangkok even. So
that's very true. I think the air access is absolutely crucial. Chinese airlines have been ahead of the game on that. You know, they've been flying in and out of Southeast Asia, not just from the major cities of China, but some of the secondary and tertiary cities. You're seeing regular flights. But India too is starting to happen. I noticed that Singapore Airlines has done a joint venture with Tata in India to launch an airline. I think it's called Vistara.
Mm-hmm.
And this year they launched the first direct flights for that airline from Mumbai and Delhi to Singapore.
Okay.
I'd imagine over the coming years they'll try and diversify that into other key hubs in the region. So that's one element. And we've seen also, I mean, we tend to go to quite a lot of the travel industry shows.
Yeah.
We go to ITB Asia, and over the last 2 or 3 years, we've noticed this sort of leveling. There's still a big concentration on the Chinese market, but we've seen more focus on the Indian market.
Yeah.
And ITB Asia, which is a spin-off of ITB Berlin, which is the world's oldest and biggest travel show, it launched its own specific China version, ITB China, back in 2017 in Shanghai. In 2020, it will launch a dedicated ITB India in Mumbai.
I think
that really represents the rising status of India as an outbound market. And of course, with the proximity to Southeast Asia, a lot of that travel is heading this way.
Exactly. So exciting times for 2020 for Southeast Asia.
I think it is. And I think we'll start to see tourism boards looking more to Indian second and tertiary cities, but also spreading their load. You know, they are really looking at Korea and Japan because these are the strong markets.
Yes.
Australia is starting to grow in some countries. It's always been quite popular to Indonesia and Bali, but you're seeing Australian tourists because there are so many more flights, particularly from Vietnam.
Yes.
You're seeing a lot of Australian travelers going to around Vietnam. So, I think we're going to see a much more diversified mix. It really depends then what happens with the European market, and you work quite closely with the European market, but will we see a further tapering off of European arrivals into Southeast Asia?
Well, we may well do. I think it's a lot down to do with currency as well in Europe. And I mean, towards the ringgit, it's quite strong at the moment, the euro, but places like Thailand with the Thai baht, that's been getting very, very strong against other currencies. And, you know, I've read lots of articles recently about how tourism is down, and not just from Europe, but also from destinations like China too, you know, where you have a lot of the beach resorts which are empty just because of that exchange rate is no longer as favorable towards outside foreigners, outside of Thailand.
I think it's also, I mean, from Malaysia, you're seeing a little bit of an impact to Thailand because, as you said, the Thai baht has been so strong.
Yes.
A lot of Southeast Asians are quite value conscious, and that big differential in the exchange rate is having an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, they're looking to places like Indonesia instead, where the currency can go a little bit further. China and India, then, ones to watch out for.
Definitely, definitely. And just before we move on, I think one of the important case studies this year was, we don't talk about it too much, but is Laos.
Oh, yes.
Laos is quite an interesting market because its tourism inbound arrivals over the last two or three years have been quite disappointing. But this year, to try and alleviate that fact, it launched what was called the Visit Laos China Tourism Year.
Okay, yep.
Last year, Chinese tourism arrivals to Laos were growing quite fast. I think they reached about 800,000.
Mm.
This year, they're targeting more than 1 million for the first time.
Wow.
And I think over the next 3 or 4 years, they're trying to raise that up to about 2 million. There are some factors that make Laos quite interesting to China. One is obviously its geographic proximity.
Yes.
It has a land border.
Yeah.
So Chinese travelers can drive.
Yeah.
And you apparently in Laoang Prabang this year, you're seeing a lot more Chinese travelers actually drive into the city, which you didn't before.
No.
Laos only has 4 international airports, but you're also starting to see more Chinese airlines flying in and out.
Mm.
But the big development, the big infrastructure development, which is happening over the next, well, it's in place now, but it will open in the next 2 or 3 years, is this rail link that's coming from Kunming in southwest West China.
Yeah.
And that will go through Laos, through all the interesting tourism parts, and to Vietnam, to Vientiane, which is on the Thai border.
Yeah.
And this presages, hopefully, for China's sake, a railway that will go through Southeast Asia. So perhaps it will go on through Thailand, down to Malaysia, even to Singapore in future.
Yeah.
So that's one to watch, because that will bring more Chinese tourists into Laos for sure.
Yes.
But that takes them right up to the border with Thailand. That means there could be more overland travel.
Exactly. I mean, and we know Chinese tourists are very comfortable traveling by train. It's still a really common way to get around. So if there's this rail link that's going all the way down to Thailand, then I can see lots of Chinese tourists wanting to take advantage of that, particularly if they're already in the Yunnan province, you know, on the border.
Yeah. With and it will also link up from Kunming, it will link up to China's high-speed rail network. So it'll make travel into Southeast Asia a different experience, because it will be over land. It'll probably be slower than flying, but it will be a different experience.
Yeah.
And in quite an experiential market, that could be an interesting development.
Definitely.
So, Hannah, we're going to move on to our second topic, which is a particular area of your expertise here.
Yes.
So our second theme is Muslim travel and lifestyle, which has really hit a mainstream spotlight this year.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we've seen a slow growing interest in Muslim travel over the past 5 years or so. But I would say 2019 is really a year where it's starting to shine. So, for example, you had ITB Asia. Again, like Gary was saying, the biggest fair in Southeast Asia, really, taking place in Singapore. They had a whole stage dedicated to Muslim travel again this year. So 3 days of non-stop talks about the potential of the market, about how travelers can attract, or how tourism boards, can attract Muslim travelers. And right, I think, how many weeks ago? 2 or 3 weeks ago, Dinar Standard, who are a big kind of consultancy, released their report about the Islamic economy and saying that travel itself is forecast to grow up to $274 billion by 2024, and it's only at $189 billion last year. So that's over almost another 100 billion it's got to grow in 6 years.
Yeah, it's an astonishing figure. Okay. And it's interesting that you mentioned ITB Asia. For anybody listening out there that doesn't know, Hannah was actually speaking on this topic at the event. She did two speeches. But one of the interesting, we'll come to that in a minute, but one of the interesting things this year particularly was how it was, that there was a greater focus on segmenting the market.
Yes.
It wasn't this overall Muslim traveler thing.
Yeah.
It was looking at millennials. It was looking at female solo travelers. Yeah. It was looking at family travelers. It was looking at whole different areas because this is a huge market. And you've done a lot of research into this area.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So rather than just saying Muslim travelers, you know, like you're saying, Gary, there's all sorts of segments within that. So you have people like Crescent Rating who've released reports on what do millennial travelers are looking for, what even Gen Z travelers, what are they looking for, how are they driving travel trends, female Muslim travelers. There's also looking at what country they're from. Of course, just because you're Muslim doesn't mean that you're all the same or that you have the same kind of standards. So an Indonesian Muslim might have very different expectations to a Malaysian Muslim, to a Bruneian, to a Singaporean Muslim. Of course, Singapore also has a significant Muslim population. And understanding that kind of segmentation is really key to be able to form your marketing plans.
One of the speeches that you gave, you did an interview on stage, and you had Tourism New Zealand.
Yeah, we had Tourism
New Zealand. You also had Taiwan as well. And it was interesting to hear their different perspectives.
Yeah, exactly. So New Zealand, I mean, I think they very much see Muslim travellers as part of the whole strategy. So they're developing resources, halal food guides and so on. Whereas Taiwan is actually from a kind of different perspective. So we were lucky enough to have, he was the former imam of the Taipei Grand Mosque, and then he'd done a lot of work together with Taiwan Tourism to develop the infrastructure. So he kind of done it the other way, and he'd seen that there was this need to develop Islamic tourism, and he'd seen the potential of it himself because he was on that side. He'd been running a tourism agency, and from that he kind of influenced the tourism board, I think, to take more steps to develop the infrastructure. And you're really seeing that kind of collaboration going on in other countries as well. So, for example, Korea and Japan this year have been doing a lot to try and attract Southeast Asian Muslim travelers. I mean, and they're not even really so much looking at Middle Eastern Muslim travelers. It is Southeast Asia. They want to attract the Malaysians, the Indonesians to come visit, and they're doing really well. These are countries that are not really thought of as being particularly Muslim-friendly. Korea and Japan, you've got language barriers. You haven't got a very big population of Muslims there at all. Yet somehow, for Muslim travellers now in Malaysia and Indonesia, these are some of the most popular countries that people want to go to. So,
Earlier this year, you did some research into tourism boards around the world and how they are approaching and facilitating Muslim travel.
Yeah.
We'll repost that on our Facebook site, but I imagine you'll do a new version in 2020.
Yeah, I will do. And what I really wanted to look at was, because everybody predominantly researches travel online now, was really looking at what do people do, or what do tourism boards in particular do in terms of online resources aimed at Muslim travelers? So do they have a website? Do they have an ebook? Do they have an app? Do they have a PDF you can download? And the interesting thing was, and I looked at 50 of the top most visited countries in the world, that 8 out of 10 of the top scoring ones are actually based in APAC.
Right.
So there's really that interest and that awareness here in APAC that actually Muslim travelers are something, or an economic opportunity, essentially, to target. Whereas Europe, USA, they're not really putting many focus at all, if any, resources behind it.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting to see the differences between that. I mean, perhaps geographically, because Korea and Japan are closer to Southeast Asia, then they see that potential there. And they know if they want to attract Malaysian tourists, they want to attract Indonesian tourists, they have to be able to cater to Muslim tourists because the Muslim population forms such a great percentage of the overall population that if you a not a Muslim-friendly country, then you're automatically cutting off those opportunities to get more tourists.
And you mentioned Indonesia there, which this year has really taken a lead into developing the Islamic economy, not just in tourism, but in lifestyle, actually in all across the whole sectors of the economy.
It has.
For anybody listening out there, it's quite an interesting thing that Indonesia's been doing. It's begun the mandatory halal certification of food and beverage products. So all the food and beverages that will be sold in the country by 2024 will have to have an official halal certification.
Yes.
This is going to be rolled out further. This is going to be rolled out to cosmetics, pharmaceuticals, financial services products.
Yes.
Ultimately, in future, this will probably go to other levels of consumables.
Yeah.
There was an interesting tidbit that I picked up last week that the first halal spectacles have been launched in Indonesia this year. So we're really seeing this development of lifestyle aspiration, consumer society. It's not just about travel, but of course, it all becomes encompassing.
Yes, yeah. I mean, so you have Islamic finance and all the different regulations with that. That's a huge opportunity there. You've got modest fashion, of course, like you say, food. And it's really interesting about this mandatory halal certification in Indonesia, because traditionally Indonesian Muslim travelers are actually seen as pretty relaxed when they go abroad.
Yeah.
So if you compare them to Malaysian travelers, Malaysian ones will often ask for a halal certificate for the restaurant. So if you're organizing a tour for them, they will want to see that. Their passengers have to see that for them to feel comfortable. Indonesian tourists generally, traditionally, have been a bit more laid back. They have said, oh, okay, just pork free. Give me pork free. You know, I don't mind about the halal certificate.
Right.
But now, if you're now bringing in this mandatory halal certification, it'll be interesting to see how that affects it in the longer term. Because I imagine then that as Indonesian tourists, become used to having that certification at home, they're going to increasingly demand it when they're abroad too.
Yeah, yeah. And we mentioned before that, you know, this Asia really is a sort of crucible for where this is happening, but it is happening worldwide. And we noticed one of the things we picked up was the Toronto Raptors basketball team claimed to be the first NBA team to offer branded athletic hijab for Muslim women. This is really becoming a global phenomenon.
It is, you know, and in the news, I think 2 weeks ago, it was that Marks and Spencer's have launched their own range of, frozen halal ready meals. So you can see there's this kind of acceptance, and it's not necessarily acceptance, actually. It's more the recognition that this is an economic opportunity. So the same would go back to Indonesia. The challenge that they have then is to educate the tourism stakeholders. And a lot of them are a bit skeptical about, you know, do we really want to get all of these facilities in place for Muslim travelers? Is that just a kind of creeping Islamization of Indonesia? But actually, it's an economic opportunity.
Yeah.
And when you kind of look at the stats and you realize by 2060, 1 in 3 of the world's population are going to be Muslim, you start to think, hang on, actually, let's get ahead of the game here and let's start putting in all of these kind of products and facilities into place.
I absolutely agree. So I think we would both say that the China and India market and the Muslim travel and lifestyle market, these are not going away. These are going to be big determinants over the next few years, certainly into 2020 for sure.
Yeah.
So we'll come to our third feature, which I think this year has really galvanized a bit of global attention for Southeast Asia, and that's the super apps.
Yes.
Primarily, it's the battle between Gojek and Grab, which has made headlines. It's made stories from some of the world's most famous publications. But when you actually live here in Southeast Asia, you see and experience it every single day.
You do.
Now, from a lot of the research that I've done over the past 12, 15 years in China, this has been a growing phenomenon, the super apps. We've seen WeChat, Alibaba, but particularly we've seen Ctrip, which is now called Trip.com, we've seen Meituan and Dianping, and we've seen Fliggy. And these are lifestyle services companies that pretty much do everything for you, or you can do everything from them online, using an app, using a payment service. And this has been developing over time. Now, those have suffused into Southeast Asia.
Yes.
We see Alipay and WeChat Pay. We see them everywhere now.
Yes.
We didn't 2 years ago.
No.
But Southeast Asia has now developed its own versions.
We have our own flavors.
So should we talk a little bit about Grab and Gojek and how we use them?
Yeah. I mean, so I use Grab multiple times a day, really. So it's not only just to get you from point A to point B, you know, a bit like Uber for people listening. And actually Uber invested, ended up, they had a very fierce, intense competition in Southeast Asia for a few years, and Grab won, and Uber ended up investing in Grab. So it's for transportation, it's for your food delivery. You can book hotels on it. They've got a partnership with Agoda. Of course, they've got the digital wallets. Mm-hmm. And even just yesterday, they announced they're launching their own card, their own payment card. And I think, it's a bit similar to Gojek, really, in that what they're doing is, a lot of people in Southeast Asia don't have access to bank accounts.
Yep.
There's a lot of, they call it unbanked populations,
yep.
in places like Indonesia, in the Philippines. And apps like Grab and Gojek allow these people to be able to make payments digitally that they wouldn't have been able to make before. So even just this introduction of this card, this, and it's in collaboration with MasterCard, if you think instantly, it's going to give all of these unbanked people a chance to really make purchases on some websites where you have to use a credit card or you have to use a debit card.
Yep.
So the potential for growth is really huge. So you probably know a little bit more about Gojek than I do. You want to tell
me? Yeah, I think, well, let's take a step back, because this year is really where this sort of battle between the two has taken off. But if we go back to where they both started, Grab started in Malaysia.
Yes.
And it actually originally was called My Taxi, T-E-K-S-I, which is the local derivation for taxi.
Mm.
And that's all it was. It was just a point-to-point service on an app. But it started to develop, it started to get funding, and then a bit like you're seeing with the super apps around the world, it moved into lifestyle services and now is based in Singapore.
Yes.
Gojek started just, I think, about a year before, but it didn't actually build its app until a few years later. But Gojek was an interesting case because it basically started as a motorcycle ride sharing app. Yeah. Or way to travel around Jakarta because the traffic is so bad.
Awful.
Passenger motor riding has always been popular there.
Yeah.
So they saw an opportunity to develop that. Both Grab and Gojek were developed by bright minds. I think they were both Harvard graduates that were behind these projects.
Yeah.
But they've developed over the last 8 or 9 years, one from its Indonesian base, one from its Singaporean base, and they are now used in most countries in the region.
Yeah.
Last week when I was in Yangon, getting from the airport, going to meetings, going to trade shows, you just use the Grab app.
Yep.
In Indonesia last month, I used the Gojek app.
Yes.
You know, it's made travel perhaps a little bit more predictable.
Yes.
But if you're traveling for business, it's made it a lot more easy as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you don't need to use payments. It's all via...
It's so much easier from your card. Used to be.
So Gojek now has actually called itself a super app. On its website, it actually labels itself as a super app, which is rather grand. It says that over the next 5 years, it wants 50%, at least 50% of its users to be outside Indonesia.
Wow.
So that means it's going to ramp up pretty fast.
Yes.
And I think the ramping up that we're seeing beyond their home nations is largely because of the financing they've both been able to achieve. If you look at some of the finances that are behind these companies, you know that these are major players.
So we can
only expect that these companies will get bigger and they will offer more services day by day by day. But it's not just about Grab and Gojek in the region. These are the ones that are really leading the online game,
I would say. Yes.
But wherever you travel, we're seeing online travel agencies with it. There are so many digital payment apps now.
So many.
I mean, there are at least 4 or 5 here in Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, that they have their own ones as well.
Yes.
But the online travel booking is also getting interesting. Traveloka from Indonesia, that's gaining a lot of finance.
They are.
Ticket.com also from Indonesia is gaining a lot of finance.
Yes. And then you've got AirAsia. So, of course, AirAsia are one of the, I would say they are the biggest driver behind ASEAN travel, between, you know, even international travel, really in Southeast Asia. I think they're the ones who really kicked it off. And now they are, again, they're wanting to make themselves a travel technology company. So they don't even want to call themselves just an airline anymore. They want to be more of a lifestyle product. They want to have anything you could possibly need that is related to travel all on the one platform. And they said what they want to become: Kayak, TripAdvisor, Groupon, eBay, all in one app. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And last month in November, they were even selling flights that were not AirAsia flights on their website. Yeah. Which is a pretty...
To Spain, I think they launched the biology.
Yeah, they were going to Madrid. So it's really interesting to see how that is going to play out, and whether this gamble of kind of really being an OTA, you know, it's an airline becoming an OTA rather than an OTA selling other airlines, is going to work out. Of course, they've got their own digital wallet, BigPay, you know, this card, again, that you can spend in different countries without the currency conversion tariffs. And so it's all happening.
For these three companies, well, all of the companies are involved in this. By going transnational across the region in ASEAN, you have a very big market. You know, it's almost 650 million people across the region.
Yeah.
Increasingly, it's a mobile-first region. Yes. Everybody uses smartphones.
Yes.
Even in rural areas, you know, you see smartphones being used all the time. E-commerce is becoming a very, very big part of people's lives.
It is.
Ride hailing is just used almost without thinking.
Really. Yeah.
So these areas are going to become much, much stronger. And I think this was highlighted by an article which was published last month in Caixin, which is a Chinese magazine, which usually focuses on technology and finance issues in China. And its headline was that Southeast Asia becomes the region's next tech battleground.
Hmm.
And it actually gave quite a nice quote. It said, "As China's internet sector cools following years of white hot growth, companies and investors are turning to Southeast Asia as the next frontier."
Now, there we go. There we go. Just what we believe.
Just what we believe. So that's one to watch. I think next year, watch out for Gojek, watch out for Grab, watch out for AirAsia, because their development is quite fast. They're very ambitious.
Very fast,
but there will be other companies to watch as well.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Which brings us to our fourth issue.
So that is, we were just touching on it, really, the growing number of travelers that are doing intra-ASEAN travel. So they're not even necessarily leaving the region. They're just in Southeast Asia. But there's a huge amount of overall growth. So PATA, which is the Association for Asian Pacific Travel Agents, said that the growth will be 8.1% for Southeast Asia in 2019, and that's just intra-ASEAN travel. So as an example, for Singapore in 2018, it was actually the second top source market for Southeast Asian nations after China, with 14.1 million arrivals. So they really travel and they really have an impact on each other. And we kind of forget, because, you know, a lot of people think of Southeast Asia as one market, but actually they travel within that. Of course, they travel domestically, but they also travel within that market too.
Yep, and there are a number of drivers that are actually pushing this development. It's a big market. Some of the bigger markets here, Indonesia is a huge market. Vietnam is growing very, very fast as an outbound market. Singapore and Malaysia are traditionally very strong outbound markets.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of potential to grow this even further.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of the airlines developing more routes within the region.
Yeah.
Although cities like Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Singapore, these are hubs and they drive a lot of traffic around the region.
Yeah.
Some of the route networks around the region are still quite undeveloped, particularly in countries like Myanmar, Laos, even Philippines. They have quite strong, Philippines has quite strong domestic travel, but the inbound, outbound routes, there's still a lot of growth potential there.
Yeah.
So this is not going anywhere. This is going to develop very, very fast.
It really is.
One of the things that I think that has also changed the way people perceive travel in the region is this desire that travel is part of lifestyle. And there's a greater desire for trip frequencies. People want to travel more throughout the year.
Yeah.
And from Malaysia in particular, because we have AirAsia has just revolutionized the whole the whole air system.
Yeah.
But also we have Melindo as well.
Mm.
It's not too expensive to travel to the local countries.
No.
For long weekends, for the national holidays.
Yeah.
There's more opportunity to take more shorter trips.
Yes.
Perhaps than the longer haul trips.
Yeah.
That's one of the things we're seeing.
I think absolutely. And then, of course, you have all of the travel agencies, I was saying, people like Traveloka, Agoda, Booking.com, who are also throwing out promo fares and good deals all of the time as well, which just makes travel seem a really attractive thing to spend your spare cash on. And actually, there was Nielsen do a consumer confidence survey every quarter. And their latest one for Q3 for 2019 for Malaysia was that 40% of Malaysians spend their spare cash on going on vacation.
Right.
And there's actually increased in Q2, it was 28%. That's actually gone up to 40%. So they would rather do that than spend their cash on other things. And I think that really shows to me that, like you say, it's just a key part of your lifestyle, travel. Yep. You know, it's not something you want to sacrifice.
Yep.
Even if you don't have that much money, you still want to go, even if it is just a short haul, 1 hour flight away, staying in a local homestay, you're still traveling.
Yeah. And I think if you look at the figures, the intra-Asian arrivals over recent years are relatively modest given the potential size of the market. If you go back to 2012, it was just under 40 million intra-Asian arrivals, intra-ASEAN arrivals.
Yeah.
And in 2018, that went up to 48.5 million.
Yeah.
So I think that inevitably this year that will break through the 50 million barrier.
Yes.
But even 50 million, when you look at the size of these outbound markets, is relatively small. Yeah, there's a huge window for growth there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and you know, everyone's always talking about the growing middle class, but it is this growing middle class and young population that are going to drive that growth. You know, these young people want to go out, they want to travel, they probably feel more connected in a world with social media, that they just want to go and experience it for themselves. They're not happy to just stay in their hometown anymore.
And we're noticing also this year just how important ASEAN markets are to their neighboring countries. So I think in the first 11 months of this year, Thailand was Vietnam's fastest growing tourism market, which you wouldn't expect given the growth that we see from China and in India.
Yes, yes.
But I think growth arrivals during that period was something almost just short of 50%.
Wow, that's a huge increase.
That's a huge figure.
Yeah.
And that's probably accelerated by the number of flights
that
are going between the two countries.
Yeah.
Vietnam's two biggest markets, which are China and South Korea, only grew by 15.3% and 22.4% compared to that. So that's more than
double. Stagnant compared to almost 50%. Yeah.
who would ever have thought that China growth would be stagnant? So this year, around 1 million Vietnamese visited Thailand. And it's in the top 10 markets almost from nowhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, we overlook it, I think, sometimes in terms of trends. And sometimes it's more exciting to look at where's everyone from ASEAN traveling? Are they all going to Europe or America or Australia or Japan? Yeah. But actually, there's a huge amount of movement within ASEAN itself.
Yeah, and one of the things I noticed in Myanmar last week is there's been a lot of focus on the inbound market to Myanmar.
Yeah.
The political situation that's been happening there means that inbound arrivals generally a little bit lower, and particularly from European countries, struggle quite badly.
Yeah.
From China, it's up a bit. Mm. India, it's up a little bit.
Mm.
But the market that tends to get overlooked is the outbound market from Myanmar, which has huge potential.
Absolutely.
Except for the fact it just doesn't have enough flights.
Yeah.
But as that starts to develop over, Yangon Airport has just been upgraded. Mm. It's much, much bigger now. I think it was mostly done by Japanese funding.
Okay.
But there's a lot of capacity there. They really could have more flights.
Yes.
It's just a matter of those airlines doing the deals to take passengers out of the country.
Exactly. And even when I was in Cambodia, on a travel trade event earlier in the year, again, I was amazed to find the volume of Cambodian agents sending groups out to Europe. And, you know, you think of Cambodia as being this poor country. How can anybody afford to possibly travel to Europe? But that's just not true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Again, this is probably one of the stronger elements of travel this year, but it's going to be developed even further throughout the 2020s.
Yeah, and I mean, and that probably leads us quite nicely to our last topic, our fifth trend of 2019. Which we've seen really, Southeast Asian travelers becoming more adventurous with where they're choosing to go. So we're talking about, yes, they travel intra-ASEAN, but they are, well, intra-ASEAN are going to more adventurous destination choices too. We're definitely seeing that trend towards experiential that I think a lot of other Western nations have been seeing. But they're also going for really exotic destinations. So one kind of top one that I have seen, and you know, this is not everybody traveling there by all means, is places like Murmansk in Russia. And I've seen a lot of Malaysian, a lot of Thai travel agents advertising Murmansk as a tourist destination, as an alternative place to go see the Northern Lights.
I was just going to ask you, why Murmansk?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously Iceland, Finland, Norway, Alaska even, these have all been really popular places to go.
Yep.
They're all quite pricey.
Yep.
So Murmansk has been maybe a little bit clever in that it's a better value place to go and see the Northern Lights from.
Yeah.
And all of these tourists are suddenly hopping onto that. And with the fact that Thais don't need visas to go to Russia either, it's kind of a no-brainer.
And I think Vietnam is also pushing for the same rights.
Yeah.
Because the Russian inbound market into Vietnam is growing quite fast.
Yes.
Vietnam wants reciprocal rights so that its travelers to Russia don't need to.
But
there's an interesting point that you made just there, that Murmansk is actually promoting itself more strongly.
Yeah.
This is a trend that we're seeing, isn't it?
So yes.
Southeast Asian travelers are becoming more adventurous.
Yes.
But a lot of this is actually because more countries are actually saying, come join us.
Yeah, I mean, and it's this slow waking up of tourism boards realizing Southeast Asia has potential and saying, hang on, we're not just going to focus everything on China or Japan or India. Hang on, what about this market? And, you know, at ITB Asia, you had booths from all sorts of exotic destinations. You know, Guam, Azerbaijan, who else was there?
Tajikistan.
Yeah.
Yeah, and parts of India that you wouldn't normally expect to be promoting themselves were there. There were a lot of countries, and I noticed also some of the Scandinavian countries weren't just promoting as Finland or as Sweden.
Yes.
They actually had some of their regional tourism boards were making big plays, and they had some of the bigger booths, actually.
Yeah, I think Rovaniemi, so this Lapland in Finland, they had a big booth there, beautifully decorated.
Yeah.
And they're really going out saying, visit this region, you know, don't bother with the rest of Finland, forget Helsinki.
Right.
Come up and visit us and see Santa and see the Northern Lights. And during the summer, do all of these exotic kind of different activities that you can do in Finland.
I mean, I agree with that. I think the interesting one you mentioned there is Azerbaijan, because I think we've really seen Central Asia really up its game in terms of promoting itself into this region, which you haven't really seen that much before, but it's close proximity. Perhaps there's not enough flights, but particularly on charter flights, it has a big opportunity here.
Yeah,
I mean, and it's a pretty unexplored territory for many people in the region.
It is, and they are, again, a very Muslim-friendly destination, so that works well with the market. And you have airlines like Air Arabia now flying to KL, and they are, you know, they have really good connectivity to places like Azerbaijan, to places like Tbilisi in Georgia as well. So that is also helping the market to explore these kind of destinations. But I mean, you even have at Mata Fair, which is the big consumer fair in KL, you had South Africa with a stand there.
Right.
So people are becoming more and more
adventurous. And Macau, which Macau is a big destination primarily for Chinese tourists.
Yes.
And it hasn't really taken off that much in Southeast Asia. But this year they've been very, very aggressive. I was at the Kluk Fair recently, earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And Macau had a big presence there. And they're in the center of Kuala Lumpur, on the side of the metro station.
Yeah.
They have a big sort of tapestry there.
They do. And actually I saw some stats. I can't remember the exact numbers, but for the past few months, of course, with all of what's going on in Hong Kong, arrival numbers to Macau have dropped. But interestingly, I think Malaysia is one of the only markets where it has increased. And I think it is down to this really aggressive push in Malaysia to promote Macau.
That's interesting. And going back to something you said there about ITB and the different range of destinations that were promoting themselves, I had quite a long chat with Armenia. And I think it was their first or their second time they'd attended ITB, and they were saying that they're still really learning about the different markets in Southeast Asia. They've done quite a lot of work in China trying to develop Chinese travelers who tend to like to visit multi-destinations. They like to visit two or three countries in one trip. And they were really trying to work out with the different markets in Southeast Asia whether that was still the same or whether they could develop tours within Armenia, which is a relatively small country, and how they could actually cater to the different aspects of what people want from their travel in Southeast Asia as opposed to the bigger markets in the region. And they said that they, from this show, they'd learned a lot, but it also gave them more to work on because they just realized how diverse the demand actually is, which they probably hadn't expected.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's working out the kind of quirks of each market within Southeast Asia too, and forming that kind of marketing plan.
So adventurous Southeast Asian travelers wraps up our five issues of the year. It's been a really interesting year. 2020 has all the potential to be even more interesting.
It's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I think it really will be in this year. So as we wrap up this show, Hannah, is there anything that we'd like to add just before we finish?
No, I think that's it. I mean, we would love your thoughts. What do you think the top trends have been in 2019? You can message us on Facebook at the SEA Travel Show, find us on Twitter at SEA Travel Show, even drop us an email at the SEA Travel Show at gmail.com.
Yep, and we're also on LinkedIn now. We'll soon be on Instagram, and we'll have a new website in the new year.
Yeah, so that's really a wrap for 2019. So we wish you all a very happy Christmas. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism with you in 2020.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.